you guys won't become heroes until you lost your map and got and ended up in a bad neighborhood and learned that people that are different from you are other people too, and came back to tell the tale at your barbecue. Meanwhile, I'm at your barbecue going, who are these lizard people?
I'm Elijah Wood.
And I'm Daniel Noah.
Dan Harmon first became widely known as the creator of NBC's Community, where he garnered the unique distinction of becoming a celebrity writer, a rare thing in this business.
He dealt with a very public trauma when he was let go from that show, but he went on to co-found Starburns Industries, specializing in producing stop-motion, traditional 2D and CG animation, and live-action production as well.
We've known Dan and his partners at Starburns for a number of years. We've never formally worked on anything together, but we've always felt a certain synergy as two independent companies who do weird and slightly off-center stuff. Starburns also produced Anomalisa, one of our favorite movies in the last 10 years.
Dan has built a career on the relentless insistence of total honesty, which gets him into trouble sometimes, but I would argue that it's the secret to his power. You're going to get a great sampling of this radical honesty in our conversation.
And remember, if you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen so you never miss an episode. This is Visitations.
With Elijah Wood.
And Daniel Noah.
And now, Dan Harmon.
Certain businesses on the side of the freeway that where I'm always like, what is Cinelise?
Yeah. Yeah. And that company, Quixote.
Yeah, what's that one?
They make trailers. And I think that's those are obviously stages as well.
Wait, like...
But they make really good, like, trailers for film production.
Yeah, yeah, got it.
Yeah, and then there's Cinelise. What if this became the podcast? Like... The setup for this episode is we're going to meet Dan Harmon, and we're talking about Dan, and then we just sort of stop talking about Dan, and then but we're still driving.
Yeah.
And now we're talking about Cinelise and Quixote, and then...
pretty soon we're in Sacramento.
Yeah, then we're in, like, Sacramento. Then we stop at, like, Anderson's Pea Soup.
Stay at the Madonna Inn.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it.
Everyone's just waiting for when we get to Burbank. They're following in real time. They're like, they should have been there by now.
Whoa. Go to Rick and Morty. Oh, sorry.
Whoa.
Yeah.
This is awesome.
Oh, man.
How long have you guys been here?
For 3 years now.
Uh-huh.
But it's season 3 here.
There he is. Hello.
What up, dude?
Hello.
How's it going?
Good to see you again.
Good to see you too.
What's up, Dan? How you doing, man? Thanks for having us.
Oh, no problem. Welcome to my nap room.
What a great nap room.
I know this is about you guys going to places where inspiring things happen, but
what happens?
You need a permit for the bar next door. So this is the second best.
This is the next best thing.
Do you nap on this couch?
I did just today, yeah.
Fuck yeah. I see your DayQuil. Is that like, what's the other?
What's the green liquid?
That's Imodium.
Yeah.
That's for the dye-dyes.
Yeah.
You're covered. Yeah.
What was the genesis of Rick and Morty?
It started when, you know, I had been fired from Community at NBC. And Mike Lazo, head of Adult Swim, had been telling me, and his right-hand man, Nick Weidenfeld, they were always big fans and telling me, you know, if you ever want to do anything, come to Adult Swim. And I wasn't sure how sincere they were until I got fired at NBC, at which point they Actually, I think I'm getting that story wrong because it wasn't that would make the timeline wrong. It wasn't the firing that prompted it. There was a point where I just started to take them seriously. Mm-hmm. I think it was because I started to get worried that I would inevitably be fired at NBC, and said, "Could I really just do anything?" And they said, "Absolutely anything, no questions asked. Just write something, and we'll air it, and you'll have total freedom." And I thought that would be probably pretty wasted on me at Adult Swim because my sensibilities are for story and character and dialogue, and I might very well be really happy with a cartoon about two people sitting at a table having coffee. And so that made me think, you know, who do I know that really fits the Adult Swim sensibility and is a huge fan of animation? And the immediate answer was Justin Roiland, who was this Channel 101 guy. It's just he's made these crazy manic punk rock kind of animations that always like defied the audience's expectations and captured the imagination and everything that I'm bad at he's good at, and so I called him and said, Adult Swim says they'll do anything that I do. So that means whatever you want to do, let's do it, and it can piggyback on me, and so what do you want to do? What's an idea you have? And he said, I just like doing those voices, those Doc and Marty voices. And this thing that had started as this joke, these bad impressions of Doc and Marty from Back to the Future, that Justin was doing these incredibly vile cartoons about Doc telling Marty that in order to get back to the future, he has to lick his balls. And it's just, Marty, come on, you gotta lick my balls, Marty. You gotta lick my balls. And Marty going, oh, geez, Doc, I don't know, Doc. I don't know, I'm not sure I should do that. No, you gotta do it, Marty. You gotta lick my balls. You gotta get your tongue all over those balls. And it just endless, just relentless. And that's always Justin's thing is like, he's in a world where the rest of us are trying so hard to do things right, but then, you know, much like when a production designer has to decorate the set with in a kindergarten classroom with crayon drawings that kids supposedly drew, because it always has that look of a professional adult that with an art degree, like trying to emulate the right. way kids draw.
Yeah. Right.
Justin just has this like this valve loose or like something with his brain that his shame and perfectionism doesn't kick in at exactly the same places as other people. So he's able to arrive at this very like liberating, lateral, God, I feel like my TV's broken kind of like sensibility that I think reminds me a lot of John Kricfalusi and Spike and Mike animated mm-hmm. festivals and stuff like that. But he's also incredibly smart and like really into sci-fi and stuff. He's not just that, but that is the thing that he does that no one else can do. Justin just has this flavor to him. So he was like, I just like doing those voices. And I was like, great, that's exactly the kind of answer I wanted, because I don't think that ideas are what make a show good. I just don't. It's like it. Ideas are garbage. It's like what is Barney Miller? That's a good idea. It's Cops in a cop station. What's Cheers? What's Taxi? What's All in the Family? These aren't premises that blow your mind. The idea is to make a good TV show. Mm-hmm. And the more gimmicky your concept gets, probably the more trouble you're in. It's like because it's going to remove your ability to bring something special to the execution.
So what is it if it's not the idea? What are you assessing?
I mean, I hate to sound corny, but it's a facile substitute for your own unmarketably chaotic family. it's good TV. Just presents you with characters that you can identify. and that you like to watch bounce off of each other, and so it's. I said, well, let's just build something around doing those two voices. And with Weidenfeld's help, we started building a family around those two voices. It was like Weidenfeld said, why don't you make one the grandpa of the other one? And then Justin and I just had many conversations about, okay, why, you know, like, let's just have him, like, dragging this kid off all the time, making this kid do stuff, and probably not licking his balls anymore, but it'll still have that kind of Mr. Bill kind of quality to the relationship, a little abusive, you know. But most importantly, like, my theory has always been that the reason people like those voices, why Justin likes doing them, and why they're effective, why people like doing impressions of them, is because somehow he's created iron filings that really outline the poles of a kind of bipolar, the bipolar in all of us, like these two pistons of all of our mental illness, where you have this assertive, potentially dishonest, but confident voice that's the voice of compulsion, saying you have to do this, you have to do that, you have to do this, you know, and then you have this other voice that's like, geez, I don't know about that. I don't think we should. I don't know. And it's just like, it's just such a primal thing. And then the rest was just like, yeah, just like building saying, okay, he's got a sister and why, what kind of parents would let this happen and deciding on stuff like that.
And then where did the kind of horror sci-fi stuff come from? And I guess an addendum to that is I'm really interested in the way how, you know, like you and like Rob Schraub and just like a lot of your friends seem to have this interest in bringing comedy and genre together. Mm-hmm. Like Schraub's office is, you know, I think of Schraub as a comedy guy, but it's just everywhere. It's just all horror and sci-fi. Everything. Everywhere you look, it's horror and sci-fi.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's hard to, because it's like you have your comedy friends and there's such a vibrant comedy community that you, if you're lucky enough, you just start hanging out with those people. But like there's so few people that are incredibly funny that aren't somehow also nerds. I think it must be the closest you can get to, that I've met, to being somebody who's just a comedy aficionado without bleeding into being a sci-fi kind of like, a pop culture geek, is maybe, oh, you're so into Monty Python, for instance. But it's like everything that Terry Gilliam's doing, it's all just compatible and all overlaps with Douglas Adams. And yeah. I think that, I mean, if I had to hazard a guess, I would say before you start trying to make people laugh or finding out that you can, the yolk of that egg is alienation, and sci-fi and horror are more prevalent and more accessible to the youngest, most developing minds that are going to end up being using comedy as a survival mechanism sometime around puberty, probably, when it starts to get into, okay, how can I survive this beating? How can I get that girl to like me in a world where that seems impossible? You know, it's like your puberty, I think, represents you starting to think about who am I to these other people? But before that, you're sort of like, you're a nerd fetus going, I'm terrified, I need a thumb in my mouth, and I need a religion to ascribe to all these noises I'm hearing around me that are threatening me. And it just seems like such a natural plunge, because it's a cycle, right, of abuse, because nerds grow up, they make genre stuff, because they have a map of the universe that was created for them by old nerds who were making that stuff that they found that gave them solace when they were young, and et cetera. And I think the comedy thing is just an offshoot. I think it's like, of those people, some people you know, of this whole family, you know, then there's like some of us find out that we have these maybe instincts for timing or something that so the comedy thing happens, and then you go like, oh, okay. And I think that's why comedy people are just, their roots are going to be in horror and sci-fi.
That's so interesting. Are yours?
I think are mine.
Are your roots in horror and sci-fi?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
What were your kind of gateway?
I mean, I mean the hugest thing, especially as it relates to Rick and Morty, was Douglas Adams.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And then I discovered Vonnegut in college and realized, oh, I think Douglas Adams must have loved Vonnegut.
Mm-hmm.
And and on the horror side, I always did love horror. We had a thing called Select TV in my house when I was a kid, and they would have horror marathons for Halloween. And my mom had a loophole in her standards and practices in the house, where if it was an expression of love for cinema, I could see boobs, I could see blood, I could see, you know, I could hear people saying swear words. I couldn't use these words in the, you know, in front of her, but she let me watch rated R movies.
Wow.
at a young age, and I think it's because she noticed that I was, loving them and like was so interested in them and was so content. I don't know. I have to assume that she was like, well, God, he's happy. He loves this shit. He keeps asking questions about it.
And yeah.
He's not carving up the cat. He seems to be. My mom told me at one point, she said, you know, you were always asking when you were a kid these questions about soundtrack and editing. Like, even before you had the words for those things, you were asking, why are they playing this music right now?
Interesting.
Why is the music sad if he's happy? Why did they start showing this and not that? I think my mom must have thought like, oh, maybe he'll be interested. Maybe this is what he needs to be exposed to for something. So yeah. I mean, I just love John Carpenter movies and everything with people getting stabbed or getting into rocket ships. I do find it hard to watch rom-coms and stuff. It's not that I can't recognize when one's good. It's just sort of like, it's hard to cross the threshold of committing to watching one. And I just sort of feel like, well, can't you fall in love during an octopus attack? it's like I just feel like why would you make a whole movie about salt and pepper? Like, why can't you get some meat on the table? It just seems like those movies need that stuff anyway. You can't just show King Kong running around. Of course, there's got to be some sappy element to it. Yeah. So why remove the King Kong?
That's great.
Yeah.
Were you a fearful kid?
Sure. I mean, I'll say yes, but I'm curious of what. I mean, I was afraid. I was afraid. I can't think of anything I wasn't afraid of.
Well, I mean, if your mom let you watch this stuff as a young kid, did you have fears? Did you?
I remember being real scared of the dark, real scared of.
Me too.
Yeah, I remember my mom would sometimes make homemade Play-Doh out of like. There was like some recipe in Mother Jones or something like that.
Yeah.
She would get out the dough and she would make a batch of this dough and we'd play with it. I remember I took a ball and I put two dents in it for eyes and made a little mouth, and it just naturally had this very creepy look to it. And I left it on the table and I went somewhere, and then my mom was like, go clean that stuff up. You can't do anything else until you clean up that dough. I just remember standing in the dark kitchen, paralyzed, just staring at this little head. I was absolutely convinced that if I went up and tried to do anything with that thing, it was going to bite my fingers off. I mean, it was like, you know, you have a few memories of what being so young that stuff was real. It was really going to happen. There really was something under your bed. There really was things out there that were gonna kill you.
Yeah.
Werewolves and yeah. And clowns, and I was terrified of little things. I had constant nightmares about puppets.
Oh yeah.
Being like murderous.
What's that? The Karen Black TV movie that traumatized so many people? Or she's being attacked by a little African doll that she picked up at a flea market or something.
What was that?
I forget the name. Do you know what I'm talking about? It was Trilogy of Terror was a TV movie in one of the episodes. It just like a shockingly huge number of people were traumatized by this.
That specific.
Yeah, but it was and then there's that amazing Twilight Zone where the woman is besieged by little teeny.
Yeah, that was terrifying.
Aliens.
Barbarella. Yeah. It's unfathomable what my mom let me watch Barbarella, but
but
I watched it many, many times, and the dolls coming to get Barbarella.
Yeah.
And that Twilight Zone you're talking about. Or was that an Outer Limits?
No, it was Twilight Zone. And then the reveal is that they're humans and she's a giant at the end.
Oh, right, of course.
Yeah. Well, I have this theory that you can always kind of backtrack through the things that fascinate and scare you in art to identify issues in your life. And I'm curious if that being when you were a kid, the fear of small things, do you have any insight into what that may have been about?
I have no idea. I remember one more too, the Chuck Wagon ads. Remember there was a dog food called Chuck Wagon, and the ads were a stop motion wagon, like a little pioneer going, yeah, yeah. And it would be a live action dog would be kind of taking a nap, and then this wagon would come through with these horses, but miniature, and the dog would start going ape shit, chasing it around the house. And I was just terrified about that. I don't know what this little this thing about little things. I don't
strange.
Know.
Strange. Interesting.
Like just that idea. Yeah, I don't know. Hmm. It's just the idea that they could crawl on you. I don't know.
But I mean, why not
big things? Big things can.
It seems worse than the big things.
Yeah.
Yeah. What scares you now?
Spiders.
Little things again.
Yeah.
Really? Spiders?
Oh, yeah, God.
Really?
I mean, I think spiders is the thing that's where I'm scared beyond rational fear.
So that's a genuine phobia then?
Yeah. I would be able to leave my house if there was a spider on the front porch, so it's not a phobia to such a high degree. But I'm scared enough of spiders that I need help dealing with them if they're going to be dealt with. I'm not gonna if one's on my wall, I can't just either let it be. Or confidently,
find a way to put it outside.
Yeah, it's gonna put a dent in my night dealing with it.
I found a black widow yesterday, or the day before yesterday, in Topanga. Friend was vacating the home up in Topanga because of the fires, and we were moving a lot of the wooden furniture outside. Mm-hmm. Put it inside so that it just was less timber, essentially. Mm-hmm. And lent this thing over. It was like a wooden chair, and there was a lot of cobwebs underneath, and there was a black spider, and I was like, that's a fucking black widow, and sure enough, it was.
That's Dan's worst fear, probably.
Campbell did a little stretching sometimes in terms of symbology, but I remember him equating spider legs with witch fingers and noses and things that, like, spindly things to children of both gender and women kind of perpetually like this theme of like kind of long invasive spindly phallic like creepy things like that evil things have long
appendages
and I thought maybe that's it. You know, like it just you're like a kid and you just have this instinct that pokey, probey things are really bad. Mm-hmm. Like things that can get into spaces are bad. Do we come into this world you know, while our neurology is forming the most fundamental terror reactions, with our big giant still developing eyes, our grown-ups that we don't trust, basically, like, they have these big long fingers, you know, and they're like tickling you and coochie cooing you in your face and stuff, and like, if that's good, it's good, but if it's bad, you know, like that feeling of like, oh, what if this giant ape that keeps grabbing my cheeks or picking me up, what if they decided to, what if they were bad, what if they wanted to hurt me, and then we put that onto witches and spiders and crab monsters and things, and alien probes.
How are you with touch in general? Are you comfortable with people touching you?
Or no.
No.
Is this the podcast where we find out that I was violated?
It might be.
Yeah, I always found it fascinating that this. I remember reading that babies at a certain stage of development, they can't recognize faces yet, even their own parents. They basically just recognize faces, period, not individual faces. And that at that point, you can draw two black dots on a paper plate and hold it up, and the baby will get that smile reaction.
Wow.
And it made me think about alien abduction mythology, where it's like, oh, what is a face? Like, what's the most primal thing that like causes you to feel I am not alone? It requires no mouth. It just requires these big black eyes and like a kind of like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Your method for this circle, like this whole method that you derived for how to create stories, how did that come about? Your breakdown of that is really fascinating.
Yeah, that's all very much Joseph Campbell and me just trying to digest Campbell and kind of obsessing about, you know, I can see that this guy is trying to explain how stories work, but Campbell was not a screenwriting guru. He was not a person that cared if your screenplay was good. He wasn't really a very big fan of movies. He didn't care. He was a fan of mythology, and so his Hero with a Thousand Faces is incredibly academically dense, and also like he's not doing the thing that you kind of want him to do if you're a hack like I was, which is say, first this has to happen, then this has to happen, then this has to happen. And so it was actually just me kind of wanting to dilute Campbell and find the simplicity. My original thought 20 years ago was, oh, this guy Campbell says all stories are the same. So if that's true, then that means if I know how to make a joist or an arch these kind of things, if this is a matter of engineering, then that means there's a way to have a kind of template and have this down to a science so that you can just change the cosmetics around or screw around with it, but that there's a way to just turn what usually what can take months into something that's just, you know, oh, okay, so we do this and we do that. You know, there must be all kinds of ways to hack it if it's systematized. And it was I never found the way to make that stuff easier. But along the way, I did find like a great deal of kind of a way of sort of at least kind of being able to point at a whiteboard and share a vocabulary somewhat with a group of writers. Mm. It's just interesting to me that on some level, like, story structure is so childish. It's like, oh, well, Jack and Jill need to go up the hill, and then they need to... but beneath all of that stuff is, like, simultaneously this, like, elegant reduction of everything that we think is so complicated, but there's also, like, this... like incredibly like intricate machine language that has to do with almost inarticulable relationships between us and this God that fucks with us so hard. Mm. And how that all of that stuff like works on every level. In these stories that we tell. I became obsessed with this idea sort of by way of paying attention to the way people like Rob Schraub talked about graphic design. So I would drive by a billboard with Schraub, and he would say things from his kind of art lobe and his art degree. He would point at a billboard and go, oh, real nice. And like he'd make some snide comment about the design of a billboard or an ad or something like that. And I'd go, well, what do you mean? I agree that that's a bad billboard, but
why?
What are you making fun of? And you go like, well, they're trying to say that that's a monkey. So the way that you represent him being a monkey is he'd be holding a banana, but the banana doesn't read as a banana because. And I'd go like, what are the rules for representing something as a banana? You know, Rob would. He would explain these things to me from a graphic design perspective. He'd say, like, you know, your eye needs to be drawn in, and then there needs to be an initial target, and then you need to know where the eye is going to go from there. And it's kind of like, I was fascinated with this idea that something is seemingly magical and organic that I would never be able to access, like drawing pictures. Be underneath it all had an element of engineering to it.
Yeah.
And that in fact, understanding that element of engineering, far from removing the joy and the power of it, could actually be harnessed to amp it up. That if you did understand why Jamie Lee Curtis running from Michael Myers is like effective, and you could, you know, it's like, and the role of music that you could like, that there's strategic things that you can do to make a better horror movie, a more memorable one, or a better sci-fi movie. I tried to bring it back to genre. And so I wanted to do that with story. I was like, okay, so you have a thing called a phone book. We all know that's not a story. It's a list of information, but it's not a story. Okay, so just as if I draw a yellow. Cylinder, even if I put lines on it, even if I, you know, it's like, if I illustrate it being peeled, will you say it's a banana, but it should be curved, therefore it's not a satisfying banana? If I draw it curved but not peeled, will it look like a banana? How yellow does it have to be? How many, you know, like, what are the rules? What is the minimum qualities that a thing has to have before we understand it as a story? You guys ever see that movie Prophecy?
No.
Not Christopher Walken as an angel.
That's the one I was thinking of.
The 70s one where the
Frankenheimer? Some weird creature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It was like, there was a sawmill putting mercury in the water up in these woods.
Yeah, I've seen that.
So all of the wildlife was becoming like mutant monster versions of itself because of mercury poisoning. And
yes.
The main bad guy was a mutant grizzly bear.
Right. Yeah. Right. Terrible effect that somehow really fucked me up when I saw it as a kid.
Yeah, it was pretty. Yeah, I remember it being really like scary.
So you went into a deep place and came out with, have you guys ever seen Prophecy? What was going on there?
I actually just petered out on the answer to whatever you had asked me, and then I looked at you guys, and there was this silence, and I was like, oh, they don't have another question, so I just made up my own. And
I'm struck by you talked about alien abductions and how aliens might try and represent a human face with a pair of eyes, and then you used kind of a similar analogy with a banana. Like, how much of a banana do you have to represent to convey a banana, and I'm associating this to something that you've talked about in the past, and that's Asperger's, which is, you know, largely about sort of working backwards through the symbolology of a thing in a very conscious way. And I'm curious how much you know that is sort of a part of the way that you approach work your work, and just what that's about for you.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I have a lot of experiences in my life with just kind of going, well, none of this makes any sense to me.
Yeah,
and then being kind of fascinated with that and going like, well, what is this? How does this work? And I'm not going to diagnose myself, but Steve Silberman wrote this Neurotribes book, and he's a neurotypical who wrote the Bible on the history of autism that the autistic community like accepted, even though he's nowhere near autistic, but so reading that book licensed me to go, okay, let's say we all have certain autistic traits, and then you can leave it at that. You don't have to self-diagnose, which could be considered tacky or heinous or something, depending on the context. But my autistic traits definitely have to do with not being able to digest at all what is happening around me. Why did I just get made fun of in the bathroom there? What did I do wrong? And somebody says to you, well, you dropped your pants and underwear all the way down to your ankles at the urinal. Like, you don't need to do that. You should have learned at some point that that kind of like your brain goes like, oh, so the goal is to remove your pants as little as possible when you urinate, which is simultaneously like, yeah, duh. But also from your perspective, it's like, no, you're the absurd one. Why do you have opinions about pants removal degrees? it goes both ways, and the only there's no right and wrong, but the supreme theme of it is alienation and otherness. I think that's why evolutionarily the frog eggs that we are, the wide net that we cast, some people are born sociopaths and some people are born acrobats and some people are born codependent. I think the purpose of autism is I think it's like hugely purposeful, because it's like this fundamental, what the fuck are you people doing? This all looks ridiculous to me. You guys won't become heroes until you lost your map and got and ended up in a bad neighborhood and learned that people that are different from you are other people too, and came back to tell the tale at your barbecue. Meanwhile, I'm at your barbecue going, who are these lizard people? Wow. Like, what are the rules of this? Why is this fun? And what is this language? And what is valuable about this game of horseshoes or this holiday you're celebrating? Like, for you people, this is the world of common day. But for me, I'm already in the Mos Eisley Cantina, And, and the idea that there are people among us that feel that way all the time. I mean, that Steve Silberman says in his Neurotribes book, he's not just wildly speculating. He did so much research, and he very clearly traces the development of the internet. It's that breed of American that had no other recourse. It's fundamental to ham radio culture. Oh. Anything where you can provide people with, a lot of autistic people, they flock toward modes of communication that strip some of the really confusing dumb shit out of it.
The art of this is gone, and the concern of self.
And if you look at this, the irony is, they really flocked towards the ham radio kind of world, where it's like, oh, there's codes for things, A lot of people with like kind of Asperger-y tendencies, they love law enforcement, like tropes and things. They like the idea of like and the attraction to like things like elevators and trains and things where there's like a system, there's rules. And they can kind of pour themselves into that stuff, because they go like, oh, well, a code 19 means this, and so ham radio kind of became, this obsession of like, how can we communicate with each other? And it flourishes, and then the irony is, oh, the internet's here, now your mom can get on it, she can play Farmville, and it's like, oh, good. This would be a great tool for bullies and Nazis and and generally neurotypical bell curve fucking assholes to just like move right in, put their feet up, and whether I'm autistic or not, I think the irony is that now I'm like off Twitter and like wondering if I should fly a kite. Well. Like, all these people that I used to hide from are, like, you know, using this thing and calling it real life to, like, scare each other and make no sense again.
Yeah.
But for a while there, we owed our country to these guys who we used to give swirlies to in high school. I thought that was beautiful.
Who were you in high school?
I wasn't literally getting the swirly, but I certainly wasn't...
You were getting or giving?
I wasn't getting. I never actually physically had my head stuck in a toilet, but I certainly was bottom of the ladder. And then I developed that into a class clown thing as I went up through high school. So.
Are you comfortable being a person who all eyes are on?
Publicly? No, I don't like it anymore. I mean, I thought that fame was there was a point where fame was like harmless at best, or maybe it was like a little uncomfortable for some people, but it was fine for me. Now I think fame is absolutely a liability. Now that I've gotten what I wanted out of it, which is branding, job security, it's like I would love to be able to go to some desk at a casino and trade in and go like, erase my name, you know, like make me just, a producer. I'm cashing in all of this. I don't want people knowing who I am.
Why?
Because it turns out you can't make everyone like you. You'll never. I think I was driven by some compulsion to get around that initial feeling on the playground. Like, one of these days, you people are all gonna, you know.
Yeah,
you're gonna regret not understanding that I'm a great guy.
Yeah, one day you'll see.
Yeah, and one day they won't see. Yeah. One day you'll be rich, and that is a great thing because a lot of people don't get to do that. So if it's true that you're special, then probably one day you'll be privileged. But one day they will not see. One day at best, you will selflessly provide them all or their kids with wonderful pacification that they so appreciate and need and take for granted that they literally will yell at you and call you a pedophile and a monster because you're not making the show fast enough for them because they love it so much. And if you're going to continue to be outraged by that and go, how dare you not understand that I'm a god and that the fact that you need my cartoon means you're weaker than me and you should be worshiping me, then you haven't grown at all and you deserve everything that you get. That's my 45-year lesson at this point, but that's what makes the answer to your question. No, I'm not comfortable with all eyes on me. I think growth is about just gradually realizing it's not about you until the point where, whether you've learned that or not, you learn it by dying. and the definition of a life well spent is reducing the transition to as seamless as possible. You know, like, oh, he was basically dead when he died. He had become so selfless that you didn't even know he was in the room, and then he wasn't.
Is there anything you wanted to talk about here in this room?
Yeah, like, well, how does the ring, is it making you invisible or does it transport you to a place that's where you can still see where everyone else is?
It's that.
Oh, it's the other. Okay, it's not it's not just simple invisibility.
No, yeah. It's not simple
invisibility. Because
it's like an inverse world.
Yeah. And is it cold there?
Yes.
Yeah, it's cold. It is cold.
Oh, that was the only moment for which it's a shame this wasn't on video. I just love the patience on your face. It's like, I understand your bit. I get it. I'm supposed to get irritated. I don't personally find that a tasteful goal. Irritate me? To try to figure out what question I want to be asked the least and then ask it. I guess that must be fun for you. I just listened to you bitch about trolling for 40 minutes. You seemed pretty self-righteous about it. I'm glad you've suffered.
Well, Dan, thanks so much.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
That was really fun.
Super fun. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, keep your feet on the ground and keep reaching for the stars. Don't use that. That's copyright. Okay. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you, buddy.
Thanks for making Mandy.
Oh, dude. Thanks for making everything you make.
This was great.
All right.
Thank you. All right.
Yeah.
Let's hit it.
Cody, I say hello.
I will, yeah.
Okay.
Awesome.
Take care, man.
All right.
Thank you, Dan.
See ya.
Bye.
Are they really leaving, or is it like a fake leaving? Like,
No, we're really leaving.
Okay.
I'm not, because I have to get this done, but I'm going to release from you.
Okay.
Next up, listen to our visit with musician, producer, DJ, filmmaker, and haunted house inhabitant, Flying Lotus. No?
Yeah, man.
Okay.
It's great.
This has been Visitations. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen so you never miss an episode. Visitations is a Shudder original podcast. Download the app or visit Shudder.com to start your free 7-day trial. Visitations was created by SpectreVision, hosted by Daniel Noah and myself, Elijah Wood. Executive produced by Daniel Noah, Josh C. Waller, Lisa Whalen, and me. Produced by Elisa Hieras. Our on-set producer was also Elisa Hieras. Edited and mixed by Graham Resnick. Post-supervisor, Lauren Magura. Our production sound was provided by Brian Curley. Our PA is Guillermo Patricios. Our stills photographer was Lisa Consol. Original artwork by Jay Shaw. For Shudder, Owen Shiflett and Nicholas Lazo. And our music was composed by Bad Bad Not Good.